Somewhere across the bifrost, way up high.
Welcome back to the latest episode of Across the Bifrost. My name is Sung Soo, and joining me, as always, is my dear co-host from across the pond, Pat Dunford. And today, we're going to do an interesting dive into the crises again. We covered them in the last 6 months in our After the Credit scenes, but we've had a lot of requests for them, and we think it could be beneficial. But first, Pat, how you doing?
I'm doing great, thanks, TT. Happy Lunar New Year. At the time of the recording, it's just gone past New Year's Day. I'm wishing you all the best.
Yeah, thanks. It's the year of the tiger. So yeah, great year. We're supposed to go to a lion dance this weekend. Depending on weather and COVID numbers, we'll see if that actually happens. So yeah, I hope you had a good day of feasting.
Oh yeah, several. And more to come.
All right, so before we dive into the meat and the potatoes of the episode, I said that again. Why do we say that again? Do we have, what was the vegetable equivalent of this we came up with? Like 50 episodes ago?
The vegetable called the potatoes is potatoes.
No, wasn't it like broccoli and something? I thought there was like some weird...
Yeah, broccoli is like the high tier vegetable, right? I remember when we were talking about X-Men way back in the day, I said like Storm and Beast were the potatoes that sat on points and you needed some broccoli to use the leadership and shine.
I don't know if I'd call Beast a potato, but that's fine. I think Beast is at least like asparagus.
He's a blue furry potato.
Ooh, hot takes. All right, so on Sleeve It or Heave It, we're going to group a couple cards together, you know, in the new Discord we have, which you can check out at acrossthebifrost.com/discord. Please join us. We'd like to talk to you. A lot of newer players have been asking for roster help, and one of the things that comes up a lot are some amalgamation of these cards, right, Pat? We have Heavy Firepower, 1-2 Punch, and Unearthly Rage, and they're all functionally the same card, right?
Right, they're all variations on a theme. 1-2 Punch is the main offender because it's in the core set. But ultimately, all of these cards cost you 2 power, have some sort of positioning requirement, and the payoff is that you get to add 2 attack dice to your next attack roll during your activation. So I thought it'd be good to talk about them collectively because neither of us really like these cards, right, TT?
No. Short, is that the end of the bit? Are we done with the Sleeve It or Heave It?
Yeah, Binum. No, so I think it'd be good to explain why we're down on these cards, because on their surface, they look appealing, right? They are a bit of a new player trap. So I think it's helpful to explain why you should be aware of their limitations and possibly steer clear of them. You don't have to. Don't take our word for it. Certainly try them out for yourself if you think they look good. Maybe you'll come to a different conclusion. But let's talk a bit, TT, about why we think these cards are just not worth that tactics card slot.
So at a high level, when Pat and I evaluate tactics cards, we always ask, right, does this provide you with an action equivalent? Or does this provide you with a unique effect, right? Something that the only way you can get this is through a tactics card. Deception comes to mind, right? Kind of immediately for that. And 1-2 Punch just doesn't do any of that, right? It provides you with a slight increase to an attack action, but it's so underwhelming in this grand scheme of things. And as far as power to impact, I'm also not really a fan of these, right? I believe all of these end up net costing you 2 points of power.
Yeah, they cost 2. 1-2 Punch costs 1 power on 2 different characters, and the others cost 2 power on 1 character. So they're all costing 2 power overall and giving you these 2 attack dice. Now, of course, if you add 2 dice to an attack that gives you power equal to damage dealt, then you could potentially get some of that power back. But even then, given expected dice rolls, you're not likely to get both of them back, and you're very unlikely to make a profit, right? You need to be rolling lots of crits for that to happen. So it's still going to cost you some amount of power. The main reasons I don't like these cards is, I think you nailed it, TT, like 2 damage dice is just not that hot. Right, it's just not that impactful. It works out of being, on average, 1 extra point of damage. And that's okay, but you can do a lot better with a tactics card than 1 point of damage, right?
Yeah, and two dice on a single attack roll, I think, is the place where Pat and I get hung up the most, right? This doesn't help you for the entire beam. This doesn't help you for the entire activation. This doesn't help you on rapid fires. And there's a couple different tactics cards that are able to help you on those things. And I think that's where we'd want to steer people too, right?
Yes, I much prefer those tactics cards that you can combo with other abilities to get a lot out of them. Cards like Blind Obsession and Smash give you attack dice for your whole activation. And when you combine that with characters making multiple attacks, like the rapid fire example and beam example you gave, right? Like Blind Obsession gives you two more dice against a target, but if you rapid fire into them twice, each attack doing an extra rapid fire attack, that's potentially 8 dice you've got out of that card, right? Way more impactful than heavy firepower.
Yeah, and the other thing I want to mention is I think it's important for you to step back and look, like, is this actually going to be better than Recalibration Matrix, which is an old card, a card that is not seen a lot, but a lot of times people get so excited about adding more cards, or really dice fixing can honestly get you a long way there, and it's more applicable because you get to see the roll before you decide if you want to use Recalibration Matrix, right? For any of these, add 2 dice to a single attack, you're doing it in front of it, and you're just kind of hoping you roll well. Now, the other flip side, to play devil's advocate, I have heard and understand the argument that attack dice gain higher value depending on the additional amount of dice you gain to the pool, assuming that your target has an infinite amount of stamina that you're trying to do. And I understand that argument, but I still don't like any of these cards.
Yeah, it's correct in theory, but it just doesn't matter enough when you're talking about 2 dice. Another point that I think is really, really important to keep in mind with these cards is, like you said before, TT, they're not doing anything unique. But actually, it's worse than that, in that they're doing something that's almost universally redundant, which is they're giving you a way to spend extra power to do extra damage. And almost every single character in MCP already has ways on their card to do that, right? So in order for this card to be really great, you need to be in a situation where you have loads of extra power and you just need a little bit more damage, and your character isn't able to themselves convert that power into damage effectively. And that narrows the range where this card is helpful even more, right? Because it's just not worth a tactics card to boost your attack by 2 when you could instead spend that power and just use your spender instead of your builder and save a whole tactics card slot.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. It's just, it's such a weird... I understand why when you're learning the game, you're like, oh, this card gives me more dice. More dice is more better. Sweet, I'll take the card. And like you said, 1-2 punch is in the core set. But 1-2 punch, particularly, it's got another awkward requirement, right? We've talked about it before. We've talked about it. We'll talk about it again. I don't like cards where you have to be that close to multiple characters. It's just the amount of times in a game that comes up where it's applicable that you can use it is just going to be lower. And again, we're just kind of doing it into the blind. I'm just not a fan of these cards. And hopefully, again, check out Blind Obsession. Check out Smash. I think those are great cards to look at. Is there another one off the top of my head? I can't think of another tactics card off the top of my head that's unaffiliated that they should look at.
I think those are the two unaffiliated ones. Smash if you've got big characters, and Blind Obsession, especially if you've got rapid fire characters. There aren't that many cards that boost damage, and that's one of the reasons why these cards, I think, sometimes make their way into the roster. But I just want to hammer the point home. Some people say, well, why wouldn't I want this? I can just use it on any attack. And like, you can in theory, but in practice, it needs to be a situation where you meet the positioning requirements and your character can't already convert their power into damage. And that extra damage is going to make or break the situation. And even if you do all that, it could still fail or it could overkill and you'll feel like you wasted your card, right? So I think in practice, the use case for this is super narrow, and they're just not worth the tactics card slot.
Yeah, and at a real high level, because again, I guess this is focused on new players, right? When you think about the value, you've got 5 tactics you're taking into battle, right? Mm-hmm. 5 of them. I'm going to go out on a limb, and tell me if I'm wrong here, Pat. 1 or 2 of them are going to be your affiliated, like, bangers, right?
Yeah.
Whatever they are, right? Yeah, exactly. Like, okay, if you're playing Wakanda, you've only got 1. But, like, you're taking 1 or 2 affiliated cards that are just like, these are amazing. These are unique to me. This is one of the things I do that no one else has access to.
Yeah, really powerful.
I don't want to get into a big semantical argument over it, but the restricted cards, in theory, are a tier above the normal cards. I think that's an accurate statement.
I think you can debate it, but certainly you should be looking at and considering the restricted cards.
And I agree. I've played plenty of games where I only bring one to the board, right? But as a general rule of thumb, right, for a newer player, you should look at taking one to two of those every time you make it on the field. I think that's an accurate statement.
Yep.
Okay. Agreed. So we're down tentatively two to four cards. So just when you look at adding something like that in, that would be our fifth card. And we haven't added any character unique cards to it. So I just, there are normally just better things you can do. One of the other cards I want to recommend that sometimes scares people is No Matter the Cost. Mm. Pat talked about, instead of making my builder attack with an extra couple of dice, could I get to my spender? And maybe your spender costs four or something like that. But look at No Matter the Cost, which is a card that allows you to take damage in lieu of power and then use that functionally to make a larger attack. It's one of the things that lets you make a spender attack on round one. We talked about it with X23 recently in the last episode. But check that out. I like Smash. I love Blind Obsession. There are, I think, better ways to approach this.
Definitely. I think that's it. Enough said. Let's move on to the main episode.
That was a heave it, just to wrap up the section, right? Because it's sleeve it or heave it. We've heaved... Heave those three cards.
Heaving all three of them.
So, again, one of the things we've gotten a lot of questions on, especially since we've gotten the public Discord up, is crisis selection. And what do you mean when you say it's a fast crisis? What is a pay to flip? Which is, I think, is a term I use all the time. What crises should I be taking with our roster? So we wanted to take a minute and kind of go through how we break these down and how we select crises for our rosters moving forward.
Yeah, this is a classic topic that we've talked about way in the past and we constantly bring back up, right? And I think it's really helpful as a refresher. Hopefully there'll be something in this for experienced players as well as new players alike. It's really good to cover these fundamentals, look at the roster you're playing and think, am I picking the right things here? Because there's so many crises now, it's very easy to make some missteps and inadvertently play some options that are just not good for your team.
It also just takes a ton of games to get that feedback in a vacuum of, oh, maybe I shouldn't be playing this, right? You have one or two crises in your you have six crises in there. You obviously only get to use one of them a game. So it's a lot of games before you get, okay, I've played this crisis a couple times now. I don't feel good at it. Why is it on my roster? So hopefully this can speed up that feedback cycle and get you that information a little bit faster.
For sure. So the first thing that we wanted to talk about were extracts and secures, right? The two kinds of crises, the two that you're going to be playing in every game. There's a few things to consider at a very high level that you need to keep in mind for both of these kinds of crises, and they vary for each one. So a few things to consider with secures. The first is fundamentally, they favor the player that's going second. And the reason for that is the... Like, level one way of getting secures is moving your characters onto them and maybe moving opponents off them, right? And if you're acting after your opponent, you have way more agency to do that. Because if I'm going first, all I can do is just move my character onto the secure. If I'm going second and that character's on the secure, I can mess with them, right? I can push them off, I can move on myself. So the person who loses priority or who has the team with more models will end up benefiting from secures more inherently. And obviously there's some crises where that matters more or less, but it's an important thing to keep in mind.
Right, and the flip side of that conversation then, right, is the person with priority is favored for the extract game. And that's important to keep in mind, right? You have the ability to go out there and if it's a guarantee grab, which like hammers or something, you have the option to go out there and grab the first hammer, grab the first spider affected. And that can be a big tempo change. And then your opponent has to be reactive on it, right? So going second, benefit into the secure, right? Going first, you have a benefit to the extracts at a high level.
Yes. And of course, those two, in theory, nicely balance each other out because the players are splitting that advantage down the middle. The next thing I wanted to call out for secures was you need to have characters that shine in the positioning requirement that the secure puts you in. So basically the scenario map, right? Because those secures, by and large, once again, there's exceptions, but by and large, those secures aren't going anywhere. So you're committing characters to stand in specific areas. And you need to have characters on your team who are good on that map. So for example, if I have Infinity Formula, which is the B map, I'd like to have some characters with long-range attacks who can sit on my formulas and make relevant contributions to dealing with the enemy team. Whereas if I'm playing Demons Downtown, no, sorry, not Demons Downtown, let's go for Deadly Meteors. If I'm playing Deadly Meteors from the core set, that's the C deployment, all of my characters need to move forward. So I'd like to have characters who are more close-range fighters or who are tougher because they're going to be put in danger more. And those characters that hang back have nowhere to hang that's also scenario relevant.
Yeah, the other one that comes up a lot is D map, which is the diamond, right? I have a close one, I have a far one, I have two in the middle of the board. I either need a really long range attacker to sit on my back D, or someone who I don't care that all they do is functionally score me the points every round.
Yes.
Because it is a long way from that rear D to engage with different people on the board.
Yeah, for sure. And this is maybe going a little bit deep, but the depending on how spread the secures are, depends how much mobility is useful. Right, like those D maps, if your characters are very fast, then they can move around and score them easily. Whereas on C maps or on E maps, mobility is less important, right? Because the fighting is more closely packed. Obviously, another thing that matters a lot for secures is displacements. If you could move your opponent's models, usually through throws and pushes, but there are other ways of doing it, right? The more of those you have, the better you are at dealing with your opponent being able to stand on secures. And the ideal secure game plan is your opponent activates a model, you move that model off a secure with your activation. Their next activation, they activate a model, and then in yours, you move them off the secure. And if you have a whole team of models that could do this, then you can get very far ahead on secures.
Yeah, I mean, that's the, again, core of the game. It'll be fun to kind of go into these in a little more detail when we get to them.
Yeah. It's probably also worth mentioning that the big common exception to secures is the pay to flips. TT, you mentioned that you say pay to flip a lot and not everyone knows what it means. So what does it mean?
So on a normal secure, I get a point if I'm standing next to it and no one is standing next to it, right? I'm immediately contesting it. And any of the ones that just score points for contesting and controlling, there you go. So something like Deadly Meteors, again, from the core set says standing next to it isn't good enough. Standing next to it gives you the privilege of maybe controlling this. If you spend a point of power. So I'm paying, right? And when I say flip it, I mean flip it to my control versus Pat's control if we're playing a game together. So there's a couple different ways that I've done this. Meteors, the pay to flip is totally random. I can't remember the name of it. What's the one that's a guaranteed? Swords, right? Sword base?
When you say guaranteed, none of them are guaranteed. You all have to roll dice to do it.
Sword base is guaranteed if no one else is there.
Yes. So sword base is guaranteed if no one's contesting it. Right. And then if someone's contesting, it's a straight 50-50.
Correct.
Whereas the others, you have to have different kinds of defensive stats depending on the crisis. And that could favor certain characters, right? Mutant Mad Men, you want physical, spider portals, you want energy. Same with Deadly Meteors.
And we'll get into those nuances a little more, Pat, right? I think the main goal here is what we're talking about is normally I just need to utilize my power on round one to deal with extracts.
Right.
If I'm on a pay to flip, suddenly my power demands have potentially doubled. I mean, it could triple depending on the secure. Anyway, you get what I'm saying. I need a lot more power out there because suddenly I need to grab extracts, which use power, and I need to interact, right, pay to flip on the crisis in order to score these secures as well, which is going to skew what kind of teams are going to be better in the beginning, the opening of these different crisis combinations.
Yeah, absolutely. And fundamentally, two ways of getting advantage there. The first is having characters that generate extra power. And the second is just having more characters. And we already mentioned that having more characters is good for secures in general.
Yeah, definitely definitely doesn't hurt. So are there any other high-level tips for secures we want to go over? Or can we jump to extracts? Do we want to dive more into the secures? How do you want to handle this, Pat?
Let's jump to the high-level points for extracts, and then I think we can build on that. So you already mentioned, TT, that going first naturally favors the extracts player, right? Because you have the first chance to grab the most relevant pieces, hopefully safely, but of course that's always the razor edge that you walk on with extracts, right? If you're too daring and you grab things that put you in the danger zone, then you might get punished for it.
I do love that word daring. Yeah. It also favors characters that are mobile, right, and able to get to these extracts quickly on round one. And if you're feeling daring, you could steal one of your opponents. Now, when we talk about opponent extracts and your extracts for round one, all we're talking about is the relative proximity on the board. If it is on Pat's side of the board and we're playing in, I'm going to call those Pat's hammers, right? They're going to be two hammers that are Pat's, two hammers that are mine, and then, you know, the one that, who knows? So if Pat's talked about Lizard a whole lot, right? Shooting Lizard across the board, grabbing one of your opponent's extracts is a strong, daring opening play. And it really leverages his mobility and his durability in order to make that viable.
Yeah, it's good. Another big advantage for mobile characters is that you can run away with extracts, right? Unlike Secures, where you are condemned to sit and defend them if you want to score their points, you don't need to tailor a character to fight where the extract is. You can have a character that's mobile and you can escape with it. And of course, that gives you an advantage in that if you are escaping effectively, you're reducing your opponent's chance of getting that extract.
Yeah, phenomenal shout out there. Like we talked about with Secures, we want to displace people. Obviously, you eventually will need to get the extracts off of your opponent's character. And the first way, the core box way, the intuitive way is I'm going to punch you in the face so you fall over, and then I'm going to pick the thing up. So it sounds simple, but it's worth saying, if you have characters that are really brawly, that are able to deliver a lot of consistent damage, they're going to be pretty good at getting extracts. And we couple that with characters that are mobile, because not only does that character need to be able to brawl, the character needs to get to where you need them to brawl.
Yes, they might need to chase after someone who's trying to escape with an extract, right? Hunt them down effectively. And then even better if they could then use that mobility to redeploy safely after they've got the extract themselves, because it's not ideal to be caught in a kind of whack-a-mole situation where everyone that holds the extract just ends up getting dazed by the opposing team.
Yeah, and then the other thing that's important to mention here is ideally you want to be able to KO or daze that extract off the person while you're in range to pick it up, which is a whole other nuanced conversation. It is valuable just to put it on the ground too.
Yes, but once again, hey, mobility helps with that, right?
Sure does.
I think it's probably also worth mentioning, aside from damage, the other way that you can get these things, it's not one specific way, but there's several characters in the game that do funny things with extracts, right? They have shenanigans that force their opponent to drop extracts in some way. So, like, for example, Spider-Man Miles Morales has Venom Blast. When he uses the attack, the target character drops all their extracts. Or Black Cat has Master Thief, and she can just take an extract from her opponent.
Yeah, Dr. Voodoo is another one that we've seen, obviously, swarming around, where he can force you to drop it as well. And Enchantress, obviously, right? Everyone should know Enchantress, but in case you don't, right? Again, same kind of thing. She's able to just take an extract off of you.
For sure. And there's a couple of tactics cards that will do similar things as well. So there's quite a lot of different options there that you could use as an alternative to damage for getting ahead on the extract game.
Yeah, so at a high level, Pat, I think those are all the major points we wanted to cover for secures and extracts, right?
Yes, and the next thing that I wanted to talk about, and then we'll tie it all together, I promise you, we'll tie it together. The next thing I wanted to talk about is the speed of the secure and what we mean by slow and fast crises, right, TT? Because this is a question that we've been getting a lot recently.
Yeah, it sure is. So some misconceptions we want to get out there. The number of scoring elements on the board does not directly tie to whether it is, in fact, a fast or slow crisis. It literally just comes down to how many points can you score in a round.
Mm-hmm. And that is what matters most, right? So the fast crises are ones where you can score lots of points, and we call them fast because when you play them, the game ends really quickly, right? Because the game ends when someone gets to 16. And especially if you play a fast secure plus a fast extract, it's very common to have a game end on round three when you're playing something like Gamma Wave and Cosmic Cubes.
Yeah, this is really groundbreaking content we're doing here. But a good example of that, right, is, like you said, right, Gamma Wave, right, which only has 3 points, but they're extremely valuable points, right? There's a potential of 6 points being scored there. And then Cosmic Cube puts 5 out there, which is obviously the most scoring elements we have. And each one of those is going to score 1, right? So we have 11 points being tossed around each round, theoretically, right, at your high end.
And then the slower ones have the least scoring elements. The fastest points are like 5s and 6s, 6 is a super extreme one in Gamma Wave. Most of the fast secures and extracts got you 5. And then the slower side is like 2 or 3. 3 for most secures, and then 2 for extracts where there's a single extract on the table that's worth 2 victory points.
Yeah, so Scrolls is an example of a slow one, right? And it's compounded with the fact that you don't guarantee that you even pick this thing up, right? I have a small percentage chance to grab this thing. If I am able to grab it, I'm going to score 2 points, right? So that's inherently a slower one. Demons Downtown, same exact deployment setup as Gamma Wave, same number of points. It only grants you 1 per. It's just an inherently slower crisis than Gamma is going to be, where a player is realistically only going to score 2 off of Demons Downtown every round, as opposed to the 4 they're going to be taking off Gamma in a normal game. Or right. 3, excuse me.
So it's really important to recognize that the speed of the crisis will dictate how quickly the game ends, and it will naturally favor specific playstyles. So the faster the crisis combination, the more valuable characters who can actually score things quickly, so mobility, and shenanigans that let you steal extracts or high damage that lets you take extracts, right? And as the game goes longer, those things become a bit less valuable. And what becomes increasingly valuable is just attrition. And by attrition, we just mean KOing enemy characters, right? Getting opposing activations off the table so that your opponent could do less to stop you. And as the game goes long, that becomes increasingly viable. If you consider that even on your best day, right, you're probably in most situations not killing many people on turn one. Turn two, you might daze some people. The soonest you can KO them then is like round 3. Like, a fast crisis combination, the game could be over by then. And so you're not getting necessarily much advantage from your damage. Whereas if you're playing a slow combination, if you're killing people on round 3 and the game is going to round 6, you can have a big push in the game where you have a big advantage for taking out opposing characters.
Yeah, and it's important to bring out, again, because this is focused towards newer players. I understand that when a new player tells me, yeah, I really just want to fight, I want to have a fighting team, that's great, but the way you're going to win with a fighting team is still on the crisis. Like, I can count on one hand the number of times I've tabled someone. It's just, anyway, maybe more than that. But it's hard to do. So what you're going to do with a fighting team is you're going to get up on attrition, you're going to have more models on the board, and then you're going to try to swing back and just score the points uncontested in the mid to late rounds, right? There are very few, I don't know any teams whose plan is like, I'm just going to literally table you every round. It's just so unreliable.
Yeah, it's super unreliable, especially once you start playing against opponents who are savvy. And if they realize that's your plan, it starts to become impossible, right? Because if I can get a big enough early victory point lead on you, and your plan is to table me, but I can start running away from you. And it starts to become impossible to kill your models because you have to spend all your actions just chasing after them.
Yeah, and the other thing, again, for new players in particular, the thing Pat hit on at first, you cannot kill most models in one round. It's going to take you 2 rounds minimum just because of the daze mechanic. So I've got to roll well enough, you daze out, you have a chance to get away from me, and I have to roll pretty well again and KO you. So it's just, you know, I've seen people having to go for these Hail Mary comebacks. They're like, oh, I just got to table the person. And you don't daze a character on round 5, and then, okay, you just can't win in round 6.
Yeah, exactly. So we don't like damage as a way to win the game, right? We don't ever advocate for KOing as your path to victory. But it is a really helpful tool, and it absolutely can help you get ahead by just letting you score more points than your opponents in later rounds because they have fewer models.
Yeah, I'm all for dazing and KOing someone in the mid-rounds and swing back on crisis in the late rounds. But just like Pat said, the plan of just tabling your opponent is just, it's not really a good plan.
It's not realistic.
Yeah.
It's not something you should be strategizing to do every game, for sure.
Just yeah.
So these are the main principles to consider when you're picking crises for your squads, right? You want to be thinking about how good are my team, different team compositions at the things we talked about for secures, right? So like, do I have characters that can stand in the right positions? Do I have displacement? Do I have a lot of characters, etc.? And extracts. Do I have a lot of mobility? Do I have good damage? Do I have shenanigans to mess around with people's extracts, right? And the better you are at these things, the faster you generally want your crisis to be, because your team is well equipped to score lots of points on that crisis, right? And then if you're not so good at those things, you tend to want them to be slower, right? And you should, in theory at least, be making up for that by having more damage and using that attrition to help you get an advantage later on over your opponent.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important thing to identify. There's a lot of different ways to go about roster building. Some people will start with Crisis. Other people will start with a character. Some people start with an affiliation. But eventually, you're going to need to identify and correlate the link between your team, your roster, and then your team, and then how they're going to play in these crises.
Yes, and it's not just about affiliations necessarily. Now, the affiliations tend to have stereotypes in how they play, right? And some more than others. And certainly some affiliations like to play fast versus slow. But it really matters what models are in your roster, right? And it could be that one simple character swap could change pretty drastically which crises you want to be playing, right? If you, for example, in your Wakanda team, choosing Killmonger versus Shuri, right? Killmonger is an attrition-focused piece that gets better as the game goes on. And Shuri is a piece that wants to stand very far away and shoot people off points and was great at the secure game. And just which of those you have in your squad could really change which crises are going to be good for your team.
Yeah, I know I made a weird face. I wasn't disagreeing with you. It's more just like those stereotypes often can get you into trouble a lot of times if you don't look at the roster and the teams that the person's going to be able to put out there, right? There's a bunch of different ways to play Black Order. And if you're just like, Black Order is just going to punch me in the mouth every round, and then you run into like a control-based Black Order, it can catch you by surprise, but it's a super viable roster. I think the biggest one, I know Shadowlands Daredevil was recently spoiled. Criminal Syndicate now is going to have two very different ways to approach a game now, which I think is fantastic for the game. And when you look at the larger affiliations, there's a lot of times a bunch of different ways they can approach things. Just like Pat said, it doesn't even have to be a leader swap, but just what characters am I slapping on the table? Because these characters are fundamentally going to do different things, right? Ant-Man is very different than War Machine.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you can play multiple affiliations in your roster as well, right? And usually if someone is playing a couple of different affiliations in their roster, it's a sure sign that they have different game plans or different crises that they can leverage depending on which affiliation they go for.
All right, Pat, do you have some examples of crises you should be taking if your team plays this particular way?
Yeah, so some classic examples. Fast crises on secures are things like Gamma Wave is the fastest. We have the new Sinister Syndicate crisis in Rogue and Gambit's box, which is 5 secure points, is the second. And then there's a bunch of 4 scoring secures. Right? There's like various different DMAPs, like Extremist Consoles, Cosmic Portals. There's Infinity Formula on the B-map. And it's very common for teams who have good mobility and good displacement to really like these crises because they're quite spread apart, but you can score a lot of points on them. So an example team that's good at that is like the core Red Warriors team of models like Ghost Spider, Miles Morales, Corset Spider-Man, right? These are models who can move around a lot, move enemy models off points, and really leverage that kind of spread high-scoring crisis map to their advantage.
Yeah, at a high level, I 100% agree with you there, but I do think it's interesting, and I know we've talked about this before, it gets a little different when you have to factor Gamma in there. I know a lot of people, like, I'm a crisis-focused team, I want to play Gamma, but the thing to consider with Gamma is you are grouping everyone up, and if you're playing against a damage-focused team, you're kind of playing into their hand there. So if you're playing Web Warriors, you just need a plan on Gamma, and you need to swap in some more durable characters, right? Maybe Amazing Spider-Man comes into the roster. Maybe this is where Vision comes off the bench for you. There's a bunch of different ways to approach it. But again, you have to look at the different crises that Pat laid out there, right? Mutant Mad Men turned City Center into Lethal Amusement Park, and Infinity Formula, right, are very different crises there. So it's not only important to think about how many points am I scoring, right? But to go back to what Pat talked about in the very beginning, how is my team going to score these points? Am I optimized to do so, right? Because Mutant Mad Men's a pay to flip and Infinity Formula is just a tradition.
Yeah, absolutely. So understanding the subtle differences between them, both in terms of map and in terms of crisis rules and effects, is really important some crises are incredibly similar to the point where they're, in terms of like strategy, they're functionally the same, right? So like extremist consoles and cosmic portals are both DMAP, 1/16 threat, 1/17 threat. Like they both play in more or less the same way. They're fairly interchangeable. Whereas spider portals on the same map is very different. So it's good to understand those differences. And if you really like those crises, it's helpful to know which ones are functionally similar, because you might want to stack them all in your roster so you increase your chance of playing a crisis you want.
Yeah, absolutely. So is there anything else at a high level we want to talk about on this point?
No, I think maybe one thing I've mentioned, because this is a mistake I see a lot, is I think it's helpful to have in mind what your, once you know your game plan in terms of fast versus slow and what you're good at and the preferred map you have, good to like have a tier list almost of like, this is my favorite crisis, this is the second, this is the third. Now, your chances of getting all of them are the same, but it's good to understand which one you might want to swap out. Do you know what I mean? If you decide, oh, actually, these crises aren't as good as I thought, this is the third place one, I'm going to swap it out and try something new. And it's also good just to sanity check to see if you've got any crises that are like duplicates that you could sub in. Because I see all the time people playing one of Alien Ship or Skrulls. These are two crises that are basically the same crisis, just like Cosmic Portals and Extremist Portals are. And it makes me think, you're only playing this one. Is it because the other two extracts you have are better for you? Or is it that you've just forgotten that this crisis exists? Because if you think it's the best crisis for you, you should be playing two versions of it. Even if it's the second best, you should be playing the best crisis for you and then two versions of it.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And then, I actually, if it's okay with you, I'd like to take a minute to talk about Secures more. Generally speaking, I feel like if you win priority, you want to pick Secures. Because I feel like the variation, it's a sweeping generalization, that's fine. We can quibble about whether it's right or not. Just because the difference between a pay-to-flip Secure and a non-pay-to-flip to me seems very high. You did quibble about it, so why would you consider it tracks?
Yeah, so right. I think the main thing you need to look at from a practical point of view, and although this is not pure theory, and most of what we talk about is pure theory, I think it's worth mentioning because you have to consider it, which is you need to look at what your opponent has and see how different they are from yours. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, that's really important, right? And you should think about how good your squad is on the same criteria you made when you made your own, you pick your own crises, right? You had your criteria for, do I want fast or slow? How good am I at like spread versus close and all that? Well, look at your opponents. Are they fast or slow? Are they spread? Are they close? What maps are they? How good is your team on them? Because you might find that, firstly, you have the same secures as your opponent at different extracts. If that's the case, you probably want to pick your extracts, right? Because you're not getting any advantage from your secures. Or you might find that they're all different, but you look at your opponent's secures and you think, actually, my team is fine at all of those. You look at your opponent's extracts and you think, oh, I really don't have a plan for Wakandan Herb. They've got Wakandan Herb. They must have a plan for it. I'll pick my extract so I don't have to worry about that problem.
Sure. I won't disagree with that at all.
Yeah. So I think it's not, I don't think you ever just, when you have priority, I don't think you can ever theorize, I just pick one or the other. I think it has to be an analysis of what your opponent has and where you can get the biggest advantage. I don't think you can ever do it in a vacuum.
I do agree with you there. I do think that can be overwhelming for a new player, right? Because all of a sudden a new player might be looking at 3 to 6 crisis cards that they haven't played at or they're not super familiar with. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden you're spending as much time in the game as you are in the initial crisis thing. But it's definitely a good point. And let's talk about Wakandan Herb then. We can bounce back to the secures later. Wakandan Herb is a super interesting one because we've talked about in past episodes, there are two reasons you could be taking Wakandan Herb. One, you think it's a really slow extract and it's going to let you brawl on the board. Because you're saying my opponent shouldn't have a way to get this herb into the vessel. Two, you think it's a really fast extract and you have a way with a whole bunch of shenanigans to get that herb into the vessel. And that's why Mystic Wakandan Herb is one of those ones that's super confusing for new players.
Yeah.
It can be a hard one to process because You can be like, I played Mystic Wakanda Herb. That thing is so slow. I'm going to put this on all my Brawly teams. And then you play against some Rube Goldberg, Criminal Syndicate, or Defenders team. Like, oh my God, they scored it on their third activation of round one. What is happening? So yeah. It's one of those ones where if you don't just be very careful, especially with it being blind pick now, about tossing Wakanda Herb into your roster.
Yes. So absolutely, I agree. Wakanda Herbs is such a weird one because the reward for scoring it is so high, but the difficulty in getting any points out of it is also so high, right? It's such a high bar you have to clear. But there's other crises that have a similar kind of massive payoff that you have to worry, has my opponent got a plan to leverage his massive payoff? And we already mentioned Gamma Wave. That's like the one secure that has a massive payoff, right? Where it's only 3 points you have to control, but there's 6 victory points up for grabs. But most of the massive payoffs are in extracts, right? Wakandan Herb, Legacy Virus, where if you can assemble the trifecta of Legacy Viruses, you can score 8 victory points, and that basically always immediately ends the game, pretty much on the spot. To a lesser extent, Research Station, where it's possible to score 4 points to your opponent's 0 after the first couple of rounds, and that can be pretty impactful. You don't agree on Research Station? You're giving me a grumpy face.
How many? It is possible. That is fair. I shouldn't quibble about that. And I guess that's fine. I like all three of those being grouped together. I was just, my resting bitch face in my face made a weird thing as I was thinking about that. I think Legacy Virus and Herb, in particular, if you see your opponent having them, you should assume that they have a plan to exploit them. I don't see many people taking Herb anymore just because they think it is going to be slow.
Yes.
And there's no point in talking about the old format because it's gone. You used to see it a lot more then because they could see your opponent's roster and be like, okay, I don't want to take this. Now, by putting it in your roster, you risk them being one of the teams that's able to exploit it.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, TT, because you've just brought back to my mind a piece of feedback I keep giving on our Discord for rosters, which is people that have Legacy Virus or Herbs in their team and they don't have an obvious plan to use it. And the thing that I tell them is, are you aware that some teams are incredibly good on these crises? And if you just take them in your squad with no plan, if you come up against these teams, they're just going to smash you on it.
And that's a great point, and it's what I wanted to get to, and it's why I wanted to real quickly hit on these extracts for the secures. There are a bunch of crises that can heavily skew towards different builds. And if you're a midfield build, if you're not a build that's going to be, I hate to say exploited, advantaged on these, you should avoid them. And I think real quick, let me run through the ones in my head, Pat, and then you can agree, disagree, and maybe we can have some talks about this. I think the first one, well, let's just start with the two. Mystic Wakandan Herb, Legacy Virus, I think are two great ones to toss out there.
They're in a league of their own in terms of they give you the most possible reward and they are the most prone to exploitation. Like, it's very hard to get a big advantage of them if you play fair, but if you take pains to contort your roster to be great at them, then you're so far ahead of your opponent.
So you wouldn't toss Gamma in there, because I would toss Gamma in the same group as those.
So I think Gamma and Research belong in a slightly different group, because maybe it's also about the characters you take, right? Because the characters you need on Gamma and Research are similar, because Research Station plays like a secure, even though it's an extract, and all of the things you need for secures apply. But I think in theory, any affiliation in the game can make a good team for Gamma and Researcher. You just need to be really good at the secure fundamentals, right? Numerous models, displacement. If you've got those things ticked, you can play a game on that crisis. Some affiliations are naturally better at doing that than others, right? But anyone in theory can do it. Whereas like Wakandan Herb and Legacy Virus, you need specific models. It's not good enough to just have general good fundamentals. It's like, do I have Black Cat? Do I have Toad? Do I have Dr. Voodoo? Do I have Mission Objective Tactics card? If I've got all these things, I'm going to be incredible at Legacy Virus. If I've got one or two of them, maybe that's enough. If I don't have any of them, I should never, ever include this.
I get what you're saying, and my brain just lumps Gamma into the same things, right? There are a bunch of characters, I'm not going to name them all, who are good at Gamma, But there's a chance you just don't end up with any of them. And especially for new players, Gamma can be extremely punishing. If you don't control that center point for two rounds, you see yourself in this big hole. And just how are you going to claw back into this thing?
You are right. But I think the difference in my point of view is I think I can count the number of things that are great on Legacy Virus on one hand, whereas approximately half the characters in the game are good on Gamma.
Let's go with a third. It makes me feel better if it's a third, Pat.
Okay.
Okay, so then that's fine. We can toss Gamma into the second tier. So you've got Gamma and Research Station in the second tier, and I'm not going to quibble at either of those. I would toss the pay-to-flips in here as well now.
Mm, yeah.
Because if you don't have a plan for the pay-to-flips, a lot of teams too, right? X-Men with First Class?
Sure, yeah.
Right, it is a way to get around it. As Guardians, anyone that's generating additional power is a way to get around it. So those are the ones that off the top of my head I would be concerned with taking if I didn't have a plan. And I guess there's a couple more. Demons Downtown comes to mind. And possibly Books. What's the name of Books? I can't think of Books.
Montesi Formula?
Montesi. What do you think about adding those in? Because now what we're talking about is the slow end of the spectrum. And I could see people getting punished for those as well.
Yes.
Is that like C tier? Do we toss those in?
I don't
in?
Think you can be... You can't really be punished for the slow crises, right? It's just that your opponent can kill you. But like, you can't lose
like
the game quickly.
I feel like that's pretty punishing. I feel like death is...
I guess it is. But it's more like... It's kind of like a inevitable consequence rather than a punishment. You know what I mean? It's not like you're like, oh, I made the wrong choice, so I lost the game on turn 3. It's like, well... We played a fun game of MCP, and by turn 6, most of my models were dead, and my opponent won by 2 victory points. It's like, well, that's fair enough. That's how the game goes sometimes, right?
I'd rather have my death be quick than the slow, agonizing, drawn-out demise. It's like, oh, I see the train coming down the track still, and I'm still tied here. Like, yeah. I'd rather it just be done on round 3 than go to round 6. I've got Rocket Raccoon left, and I'm starting at, like, Proxima, Corvus, and Thanos. I'm like, this isn't going to go well.
Oh, that's some of the best MCP is when you're like, okay, I'm 1 point down, I've got 2 models left, but if I can do this and my dice are good enough that I can daze that character, I'll get just enough power, I can do this, and maybe, just maybe, I'm still in it. I love those games.
Okay, but Rocket Raccoon facing down Corvus, Proxima, and Thanos is not 1 or 2. You're like, trips and tracks on Corvus, and he's like, he does not care. And then he just murders you.
Look, I will concede to your point that Thanos, Proxima, and Corvus do outclass, collectively they outclass Rocket. Maybe he could take any one of them, I don't know. But
15 threat is greater than 2 threat. Hot takes from across the bottom. I understand what you're saying. I just think for beginner players or people that aren't sure, I think those are additional things that you want to stay away from. I think you probably want to stay away from the Fs, and I think you want to probably stay away from these slow scoring Cs.
Yeah, but I don't know. I think it depends a bit on where your team is at. I think it's totally fine to take a slow scoring crisis and try and outfight your opponent. I think it's okay. So I don't think it's as bad, but we can agree to disagree on that point. So if
an interesting point, because if we had to assume, I would guess that most newer players are going to be brawling focused. So maybe it is actually beneficial for them to do that.
Yeah, maybe.
That's why they take 1-2 punch.
I mean, that card, it
I'm going to incinerate him with Demons Downtown, and then we're going to 1-2 punch. That's like a 3-dice swing.
It's true. So, yeah. So basically, after all of those categories, you're left with a few crises in the middle, which are kind of like crises that score about 4 points a round. There aren't actually that many of those, right? So it's probably worth mentioning the 5-point extracts as being another fast extract. You've got Cosmic Cubes and Spider Infected, both of which were the core set. And they are 2 of the fastest extracts.
Yeah, I think I mentioned it. Maybe I didn't. But yeah, I would toss the F extracts in the same group as the pay-to-flip secures. Where just think about it, I think, before you toss them on the roster.
Yeah, and then you basically got everything else, which actually is not that long a list after all those things, right? It's like Infinity Formula, Hammers, like the symmetrical ones that aren't too fast, aren't too slow. Most players can get a couple of points each of them. They're the most sort of even and fair.
They're the ones you're going to play if you have a demo game, right? Let's just be upfront about it, right?
Yeah. But actually, I don't think it's like a hierarchy. There's like these bunch of different segments, right? So we've got like the most powerful secures in Research Station, which is actually an extract, and Gamma. The most abusable extracts in Wakandan Herbs and Legacy Virus. The fastest extracts in spider-infected cosmic cubes. We've got the middle tier of stuff with like hammers and infinity formula on one side and all the pater flips on the other. And then at the bottom of this pantheon, we've got the slowest stuff, which is like all of the search extracts. So like Skrulls, Sedators, and Alien Ship that all only have 1 point to pick up that gives you 2 VPs. And the 3 point secures like Diva's Downtown and Seal's Collapse.
Yeah, I think all. Yeah, I agree with that.
And that basically gives you like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. If you split the search extracts and the slow secures, that gives you kind of like 7 archetypes for crises to consider. And you probably want your team to be good at least 2 of those so that you have good extract plan and a good secure plan, and maybe more.
All right. So I hope that helps. It's a lot of information. Do we have some examples we can give him, Pat? I think that might be beneficial. Let's start with the core box, right? Can we go over some examples for core box focused Cabal and core box focused Avengers here?
Yeah. When I played Cabal a lot back in the early days of MCP, it's a more damage-focused team. Red Skull's leadership encourages you to do damage. And I would take slower crises with a plan to get ahead on attrition. Get extra power through doing damage, take out my opponent's characters, and then win the game. So I preferred... I liked Demon's Downtown. I was fine with the single extracts that you you search for.
Skrulls, Alien Ships...
Yes, but I also didn't have, like, the team was flexible enough that I was happy to go up to kind of that mid-level of, like, average speed crises. Like, I would play Infinity Formula because my characters were particularly good at standing away from the opponent and damaging them and splitting up into 2 parts of the table. So I ticked enough of those boxes that it made it into one of my top secures.
Now, Gamma's an interesting one for Corset Cabal focus too, right? Where Gamma's obviously faster, but bringing that Brawl into the middle and using Red Skull's place, I know that was exploited for a long time using MODOK or other big damage dealers, where you just threat project into that middle, right? And it can be an interesting match there.
Yeah, just having Red Skull teleport MODOK up to the back Gamma shelter and just have MODOK activate and blow up at everyone that goes into the middle works really, really well. So... this is what I mean. This is what I was thinking about when I said I think anyone can play Gamma. As long as you've got a plan for how your team is going to control the middle of the table, there's so many different plans in the game to do it. And they're all kind of okay. They match up, some better or worse, into each other. But there's a lot of really good Gamma plans that you can construct.
Yeah, I do agree with you. And I think it's important to have a Gamma plan when you're coming to the roster. I think you need a plan for any of these, to be clear. I think like level 1 of list building is like take crises that like fit your team. I think level 2 is like, okay, I need a plan for the crises I'm going to be bad at, right? What happens if I have to play Legacy Virus? Because it's going to come up.
Yeah. Looking at Avengers as another example, I think Avengers are one of the better teams in the game for doing the pater flips. And the reason is that it's possible to have a very high character count team. They have a lot of really good 3-threat characters, and one of their leaders is 3-threat with Sam. It's possible to have a good amount of mobility, which is useful, but not necessary on pay to flips. But also they can pick characters that have good physical or energy defense, which can matter on the specific pay to flips. So my current Avengers team, for example, has Steve Rogers and Steve Rogers, who is 4 physical, 4 energy defense, right? It has Miss Marvel, who's 4 energy defense. It has Iron Man and Luke Cage, who are 4 physical defense. They're all affiliated characters. I can take them in every single squad. And I have Mutant Madman and Spider Portals as 2 of my secures. So I can take multiple characters with a 4 in that defense to flip those points.
Yeah, I think that makes a ton of sense. I think that's a good way to go with Avengers. There's a bunch of different ways we can go with them, but... yeah, utilizing their mobility, their ability to go wide, their power reduction to kind of pay for those makes sense, right? Asgardians inherently is one where they don't feel the tax as much for the pay to flips being out there. I just think it's important to remember that if your power is going to the crisis, just change your expectations as to when you're going to be able to use their superpowers and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. They're also one of the stronger pay-to-flip teams. They have more power generation, but they have lower model count because their characters are already expensive.
Okay, any others that jump to mind? I mean, Criminal Syndicate is one that's kind of been talked about as knowledge. It's a little easy. They want to stand on things and they want to score points, right?
Yeah, I mean, they have a leadership that is all about secures and extracts, right? They've got two halves of the leadership. Half of it makes them better at secures, half of it makes them better on extracts. As a result, they're kind of great at almost all secures and extracts. The exception being they're not good at pay to flip secures because their leadership doesn't work with those. It just doesn't do anything. So they're great at almost all of them, which means they want to go fast, right? Because they're going to be better than most teams. They want fast secures especially, and probably fast extracts to try and get ahead. And another team that's great at almost everything is Web Warriors, because their team naturally has a lot of displacement and a lot of characters with shenanigans for manipulating extracts.
Yeah, and then one of the things Web Warriors doesn't want, though, is that pay to flip, right? And that's an interesting, quote-unquote, counter to the Web Warrior plan, where, like, I just want to stand here and move you off of it. I don't want to have to spend power to interact with this thing.
Yes. And bear in mind, those teams, they are probably the best at crises, but they lose out of it in other ways, right? So, like, stereotypically, Web Warriors are very mobile and very good at extracts and secures, but they have pretty mediocre survivability and pretty low damage. And criminals are pretty mediocre damage and really low mobility.
Yeah, one of the old staples, right, is Wakanda, obviously, which is great at playing the scenario game because they could push things, they have reasonable durability on their characters. And when you see them out there, their plan's normally to get out there, push you off objectives, tactically remove and daze pieces. So if you want a little bit more aggro focus over Web Warriors, I think Wakanda is a good place for you to look.
Yeah, I agree. I think Wakanda is really a really powerful team that can play really well into attrition or into extracts or secures. But I think fundamentally, like, Wakanda Forever plus Black Panther and Shuri is just such a good secure game plan, right? You're going to stop your opponent from scoring a lot of points and secures with that combination.
That's very fair. And then, actually, let's talk about that for a minute, especially for newer characters or newer players. And maybe we can wrap that up there. The power of Wakanda Forever and what Pat just described is it allows those characters after an activation towards the end of the round to both have meaningful attacks and push people off. So you activate a character, I move Black Panther on there, push the character off. You respond by moving a character on later on. But Wakanda Forever giving Black Panther that out of activation attack lets him again push someone off a point, right, Pat?
Yeah. So it can just, you can control so much of your opponent's team at such a low cost, right? It's only one power, so you can threaten it throughout the whole game.
Yeah, just kind of an incredible combination there. So is there anything else we want to cover? We hope this was educational for the newer players out there. We hope you experienced players maybe learned something about the higher end crisis and how to stack them. Is there anything else we need to cover here, Pat?
Yeah, I think you're right to point out that this is mainly for new players, TT, but I think a message I have to more experienced players, try to be disciplined in making sure that you really are picking the crises that are best for your team. I think it's a really helpful exercise with every iteration of a roster to think about what squads you can make on the different crises and check, are you really picking the three best extracts and the three best secures for your team? How fast do you need to be and how good are your particular characters on each of those crises? Because I think it's very difficult to pick the correct crises perfectly, and almost any roster could probably be improved by spending a bit more time thinking about how to maximize that.
Yeah, I think that's great closing advice there, Pat. So we do want to thank each and every one of you for listening to this podcast. We do want to thank the patrons for their continued support. If you're interested in supporting this podcast and more, you can jump over to patreon.com/acrossthebifrost. Patrons, stay tuned for the After the Credit Scenes, which is a small bonus episode Pat and I do every week, about 15 to 30 minutes, where we dive deep into something. We do, again, want to encourage you to join the public Discord, acrossthebifrost.com/discord. You can check that out. And until next time, everyone, cheers and happy gaming.
Somewhere across the Bifrost, where Somewhere across the Bifrost skies are blue, and the dreams that you dare to dream.